Hello and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday local news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski says lawsuits are coming on the inland port because she says the legislation that created it is unconstitutional. Also, a Vernal detective walks a delicate line between enforcement and entrapment in sexual solicitation arrests. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints excommunicates a former LDS bishop who has been critical of one-on-one interviews between Mormon clergy and youths. And one of Elizabeth Smart's kidnappers is freed from prison. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Jessica Miller is here with us. Good morning, Jessica. Glad you're with us.
Good morning.
Always a pleasure. Reporter Taylor Stevens, thank you for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
And good morning. And editorial page editor and Salt Lake Tribune columnist George Pyle, thanks and welcome to you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Listeners, if you have questions or comments about the stories that we're covering, call us at 801-355-8255, or you can post them at the KCPW Facebook page or sltrib.com. Taylor Stevens, we're going to start with you, actually, and Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski, who made some impromptu comments about the inland port. This is a planned massive development off of I-80 out there by the Great Salt Lake. She made these comments outside the city council chambers this week. What did she have to say?
So just to kind of set up the scene a little bit, there was a public hearing on the inland port where residents could come and express their concerns about the development. 19 people spoke on a range of issues from environmental concerns to traffic and congestion. And after the public hearing, pretty much all of those people, full house in the council chambers, stood up and left, walked out, because they'd said their piece and didn't have anything left, I guess, to be in the council chambers for. And Biskupski apparently had followed them outside. And so for me, I was just trying to follow a source who had walked out and walk out there. And Biskupski is kind of giving this impromptu speech. So I ran back and grabbed my phone so I could record it. And what she said is that she thanked everyone for coming and for fighting the good fight, she said, and promised basically that this isn't over and that she expects there will be litigation against the inland port at some point. Probably won't be from her because the city council had in June blocked her from filing a lawsuit against the inland port without the body's permission. But she thinks it might be from, it seemed like, environmental groups, and said that this legislation that created the inland port was unconstitutional.
And something that people have pointed to before, the concept that it's unconstitutional because it's essentially stripping land away from Salt Lake City, taking control of what would be autonomous land, I guess, of Salt Lake City. Is that correct?
Yeah, it seemed. I mean, she didn't elaborate on Tuesday evening her position as to why she thought it would be unconstitutional. She said there's multiple issues with it. She didn't point to what those might be. But I think that's kind of the assumption, is that it would be that local land.
You know, you pointed out that the fact that the city council has sort of prohibited her from using funds to sue. The city and the council are divided on this issue, it seems, especially after this meeting. It seems like this divide is even wider than before. The city council, or at least members of the city council, made some comments about Biskupski and her comments, and they weren't very happy with the comments she made.
Yeah, and I think to understand the comments that happened in the council chambers as Biskupski was simultaneously outside giving these comments, you have to kind of go back a little bit and understand that when this legislation was created, kind of in the final hours of the legislative session in January, that the city was taken aback. They were really upset about this. They went back into a special session, and the council had worked kind of positioning itself to compromise to make the legislation more favorable to the city. But Biskupski kind of sat out of those meetings altogether and kind of on principle, I think, said that she just was not going to be involved in those. And so the council sees Biskupski as kind of this roadblock in setting up this good process between the city and the state. So while she's outside giving this speech, there had been a moment on the agenda where she was supposed to be there so that the council could ask questions of administration. So it gets to this point of the meeting, and Biskupski's outside giving this speech to all of these residents, basically completely oppositional of what the city wants, the city council. And so it got pretty heated in the council chambers with James Rogers and one of the mayor's chief of staff kind of getting in a tiff in there, people saying that she was grandstanding outside instead of being accountable to the public and answering their questions. So this divide was really on display on Tuesday.
Is it, you know, we talked about that, that divide and what the council's doing versus what the city is doing. The state, as we said, has kind of taken over Salt Lake City land with this bill. And a question that I have is it that the city council is essentially conceding that takeover, you know, reading the writing on the wall maybe, while the mayor is not willing to concede the legitimacy of that takeover and is therefore saying, you know, there will be lawsuits, although we don't know who or when. Is that the essence of the divide?
Yeah, I think that it's really easy to focus on kind of these interpersonal conflicts. It's kind of a hot topic. It's dramatic. But I think when it comes down to it, the important divide that this episode displays is that while the council is maybe going more for this reform technique where they want to work with the state to make changes to legislation that are favorable to them to make sure that there's favorable outcomes for the city, that maybe Mayor Jackie Piskupski is going for a more radical technique where she just wants, you know, to see some kind of litigation altogether.
You know, the mayor is taking maybe more a more extreme position, I guess, George Pyle. But you could look at the state's infringing on the city's autonomy as an extreme action as well. And so maybe she's fighting fire with fire. You could call that, you know, if there were a lawsuit coming from the city, but that that doesn't seem to be happening. What do you see here, George Pyle?
Well, I just from the editorial point of view, where I can say anything I want, creating this Port Authority was a really bad idea. There's no reason to think that. I mean, everybody thinks that this is a prime land for some kind of industrial transport hub. It's right next to the two interstates. It's right next to the airport. It's land out there that's the building of the new prison out there is going to draw utilities and roads and things, and that will make it more easy to develop. So the idea that that it's not going to be thousands of homes, it's going to be something industrial and transport oriented is not controversial. What is controversial is that instead of letting the city do it, I mean, the city has shown it can do things. It's completely remodeling the airport for billions of dollars, which we aren't paying for because the airlines and the rental car companies are paying for it. So they've shown they can do big things. The concern, I think, very widely felt, mayor, council, everybody else, is that the reason the state is doing this is because they fear that the city might care about the environment. The city might care about air pollution and water quality and all that kind of thing and all those liberal tree hugger things that nobody in the legislature cares about. So that's why they wanted to seize control of this. And I do remember the city council, before they struck this deal with the legislature, came in to see us and basically said, you know, we don't like this, but we can't sue them. We can't win. We can kind of make a deal. And they made a deal and they changed the legislation some so that the city still has some say over some things and it's not this total power grab. And the city doesn't lose all its taxing authority and such as that. And I accepted the argument that cities generally across the country are pretty helpless when it comes to what the state wants to do, because constitutionally there's a federal government and there's the state governments and that's it. All the cities, all the counties, all the mosquito abatement districts, all the school districts, all the cemetery districts are creatures of the state. They're created by the state. They're ruled by the state. They're controlled by the state. But I did get a letter from Ted Wilson, former mayor, who pointed out there is a clause in the state constitution that might be read to prohibit this Port Authority, this legislature coming in and standing and taking this power. And he called it the Ripper Clause. I have no idea why it's called Ripper, if it's somebody's name or it named after Jack the Ripper, or I have no idea. But it basically says that the state can't give municipal authority to some other creation that it's come up with. And it's old language. The mayor doesn't seem to be citing it in public any place as a reason why she thinks she might or somebody might have a chance to sue.
Right.
Yeah, you could read this clause in the state constitution as saying that the legislature has overstepped its bounds.
Right. Former Mayor Ted Wilson making this state this comment about Article 6, Section 29 of the state constitution.
Right.
Constitution, which says that the legislature shall not delegate to any special commission, private right. corporation, or association any power to make, supervise, or interfere with any municipal improvement, money, property, or effects, and onwards. It goes on like that.
Yeah.
The city council has essentially taken away or said that they have taken away the mayor's ability to sue on this. Taylor Stevens, could the mayor and her administration still sue on this anyway?
I don't know that they'll need to. I think that there are environmental groups that are concerned enough that I'm speculating.
Right.
I don't know. We could see the mayor do this possibly and try to, go around the council, but I just don't think that she'll necessarily need to.
If there's, a sort of moment in time when an imagined lawsuit may happen, if somebody wants to challenge the legislation that created this authority, why wait until a lot of stuff is already in motion? If somebody's going to sue, why aren't they already suing? I guess is the question. This is all speculation on your part, Taylor. Mm. You can't answer that.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know that the mayor said that she and administration have been looking closely at all of the legislation and everything surrounding the Inland Port. I don't know that she was really ready to make a public statement on this yet. I think that a reporter just happened to be in the hallway. So I don't think that they really have a strategy yet. I think that they'd maybe rather not have been on the record saying that at this point. But, we'll see where it goes.
Just to close this out, Salt Lake City residents, or at least some Salt Lake City residents who were at this impromptu gathering and who had testified, are asking for a zero emissions port. What does that mean, a zero emissions port?
There's a lot that goes into that, I think, but when you're looking at an inland port transporting all of these goods, you're looking at a lot more freight trains, a lot more trucks, a lot more semis, and that's just the transportation element of it. I think that what they want to see is, can we make these methods of transportation electric? Can we focus on ways to even out the those emissions? I don't know whether that could be like a carbon tax or some kind of way to make sure that the impact on the air doesn't get worse.
Now, there are ways to, often when you're dealing with developments or things, oil drilling near national parks and things, these things don't always work, but sometimes they do. They have what they call mitigation, and you dig a hole or you create the source of pollution or you use up this wetland over here, but then over here you turn these smokestacks into electric, you plant trees, you do various things.
Mitigation.
So that, over the whole, if you look at the whole county, say, then emissions either flatten out or even go down if you like they're redoing the airport, and they're already their airport. They're shifting to more these little things that tow the airplanes around and bring the luggage and drop your luggage on the ground while you're looking out the window and all these things. A lot of those are changing to electric and that kind of thing. So, you could take a total emissions profile of a county or a city or a quadrant, and you could say, well, this guy's polluting more, but this guy's polluting less, and it offsets, and you can count that.
I just have to, for a quick moment, jump in and plug a KCPW show, In the Hive, which talked about environmental justice and where you're doing the kinds of activities that you're doing. So you may be on the west side creating this emissions problem and doing something great in a place where nobody exists, and that's not a great outcome for the people who live there.
If you pollute the west side and you plant trees in the canyons, from a 30,000 feet up, that might look like you've done something. But if you live on the west side, that's not very much help.
Okay. Taylor, how about the zero emissions thing? Is that something that the council itself, who has made nice with the state, and we should point out that Salt Lake City Councilman James Rogers is on this board.
Right.
His district includes this land. Is that something that they are advocating for?
So what the administration is working on right now is coming up with a zoning ordinance, an inland port overlay zone, where they can mitigate some impacts from the inland port uses that will be there. What they can't do is just say no to some uses. So I think that it seems like the council is looking to do what it can to mitigate, but because this isn't their project 100%, they don't really have as much power as they'd obviously like.
By the legislation, they can't say no to specific things. That's
right.
That's in the bill. All right. It's a really interesting topic. I'm sure we will see more on it, and we'll see whether or not a lawsuit is in the works and comes to fruition. At the moment that we have to take a break, our first break of the show, you are listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Stay tuned.
What if you were sick and got the wrong diagnosis?
He had told me that my symptoms didn't have a biological cause, but after we got out from the appointment, I walked back to my house and I collapsed and I couldn't get up for 4 months.
I'm Guy Raz. Misdiagnosis, that's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sunday afternoons at 2 on Utah Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Rihanna Gale, science reporter for Utah Public Radio. Part of my job here at UPR is to bring you fun and engaging stories from the science world. If you've got a question, we'd love to answer it. Please visit our website at upr.org or call us at 1-800-826-1495. You can also share ideas with us on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram. Just be sure to include the hashtag IAmUPR. Thanks for listening.
Erie, Superior, Michigan, Huron, Ontario. The Great Lakes, each with a distinct personality. Jeremy Turner was inspired by family vacations at the Great Lakes when he wrote this piece for mandolin and violin. Chris Thiele and James Ennis play Inland Seas on the next Performance Today from APM.
Hi, I'm Steve Williams, host of Jazz Time here on Utah Public Radio. I hope you'll join me Sunday evenings for a journey through the world of jazz music, from ragtime to bop, from Havana to Logan, Utah. Tune in for a bit of history, commentary, the occasional interview, and of course, all that jazz. Jazz Time, Sunday evenings at 6 o'clock on Utah Public Radio.
Utah Public Radio would like to thank our partner, Intermountain Healthcare Budge Clinic, for sponsoring the UPR original series, Diagnose.
And welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I am joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Jessica Miller and Taylor Stevens, as well as George Pyle, editorial page editor and columnist. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. Or you can post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. I want to spend the middle section of this show talking about some in-depth reporting done by Jessica Miller, and I believe also done by a former colleague of yours as well, Jessica.
Mm-hmm.
This is the story of a Vernal Police the Vernal Police Department, which has been prioritizing sex solicitation cases. One detective up there has been making a fair amount of solicitation arrests. But there has been some criticism over how these arrests came to pass. Maybe let's start with where these cases often began, which is with these hookup ads online, often on Craigslist. Tell us about that and the work of this detective, Jessica Miller.
So we found a lot of these sex solicitation cases where this detective would go to Craigslist and he would find ads for men who were seeking casual sex. They weren't outwardly asking to, you know, hire a prostitute, or they weren't offering to pay for sex. They were just saying, like, hey, I'm coming through Vernal. Any women out there want to hook up? And so he would respond to these ads undercover, posing as like a 26-year-old woman who wasn't a sex worker, who had like a day job, but she just needed help paying her bills. And so he would start this conversation with these men, and he would always be the first one to say, like, hey, I'm interested in your ad, but what's in it for me? Like, can I get payment for this?
He pretending to be
the woman.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. So we found a lot of cases where he was doing that. So he would pretend to be a woman, ask for payment. The men would often agree, and sometimes the conversation would go on for like a day. Sometimes it would be like a week. They would talk about things like they love to go camping, or like, what do you look for in a partner? Things like that. And then they would go to the men who posted the ads would go to a hotel in Vernal, and then they're met with a police officer instead.
And the men who would go and meet with the detective, I mean, who would show up there, had promised some form of remuneration, some sort of payment.
Would say, well, what's in it for me? And some of them, it took him a little bit to catch on that he meant money. A lot of them just said, like, well, you'll have a great night or whatever.
Yeah, right.
And so it was like pretty vague, like, pay me somewhere between like $50 and $100. And like the sex act that they had agreed to was pretty vague. So they were just kind of agreeing to pay some amount of money and then go to this hotel. And then they were arrested when they got there.
So sort of fertile ground for finding potential perpetrators. He goes onto Craigslist and these are the methods that he is employing to bring about the arrests. But there is some criticism of these methods, and you spoke with one defense attorney in particular who had represented some of the men who were entrapped in, or who were entrapped, I guess, who were caught up in these stings. What did they have to say about this?
Well, the one defense attorney that I talked to, he said, you know, so I should back up a little bit. I went to Vernal to talk with the police about these stings, and the assistant chief had told me, like, we're only targeting these men who are semi-aggressive online. You know, these are guys that could be predators. And so I talked with one of the defense attorneys who had represented a couple guys in these cases, and he said, like, no, these guys aren't predators. They were just guys looking to hook up online. And another defense attorney said that he thought that a lot of these cases bordered on entrapment, but once these guys got to the courtroom, the penalty's so low. It's a Class B misdemeanor. It's kind of an embarrassing crime, so most of them just wanted to get it done as quickly as possible, you know, take a plea deal, get out of here, pay $600 and move on. Like, no one wants this protracted trial and this whole legal process.
Yeah, they don't want to challenge this because of the fact that they would rather remain essentially anonymous.
Yeah, yeah. And like I said, the penalty is so low. They're not on the sex offender registry if they plead guilty to this charge. So really all they were looking at is pay $650 or $400 or whatever the judge decided, and then they can walk away.
From your article, it does sound, I mean, you pointed this out, but it sounds at least like in some instances, this is people looking for consensual, casual encounters, and then they kind of get talked into something that amounts to solicitation. Not every instance, but some of those instances. What does constitute entrapment in the letter of the law definition of entrapment?
So you would not be entrapped if just because the officer would offer payment first. So just by saying, like, what's in it for me? Like, that's not entrapment. But so if you are talked into doing a crime by a police officer that you wouldn't otherwise do, that's kind of where it crosses the line. And they kind of prove that by showing, like, well, we had this relationship now. You know, we've been talking for a while, and he used, like, emotion. He played to my emotions to get me to do this crime. And usually you see those in, like, sex solicitation cases and, like, undercover drug buys. Anytime, like, an officer's posing undercover or as someone else. But with these cases, I think we looked at probably like 30 of them, and no one ever had argued that they were entrapped. And the city prosecutor said that he didn't think that the methods that the officer was using had amounted to entrapment as defined in Utah law.
Okay, and the department itself is actually very proud of the amount of arrests that they've succeeded in securing, and of Detective. I'm forgetting his name.
Smith's
work. Yeah.
Yeah. The assistant chief said that this was something that they were going to be focused on. A lot of his cases started when he first started doing these Craigslist stings. He was looking at child sex solicitation cases.
He had received some training on that.
Yes. He received some training from the Attorney General's office with their Internet Crimes Against Children task force. So they kind of have these two tracks running where they're focused on these child cases, and they think that's very important to keep their community safe from child predators. But then they also had this adult solicitation thing going on. And the assistant chief said, you know, that was important work, too, to protect the community. It's a deterrent for people to not commit these crimes. And he said, you know, if he could hire five more guys like Detective Smith, he would increase this caseload by that much.
Mm-hmm. Where part of the story that I think is interesting is where the reporting actually comes from, how the Salt Lake Tribune got on this story. And maybe you can tell us a little bit about the process of how you decided to look into this.
Yeah, it took forever. we started, my colleague Aubrey Weber and I, we started a project in like November where we were looking at search warrants for another story we were working on about how quickly judges were approving e-warrants. And so as part of that, we took a month and we looked at every single search warrant filed in that month. It was like 850 warrants. It took a couple weeks for us to get through all of them. And while we were doing this, you know, we'd kind of send each other warrants that we thought were interesting. And at a certain point, we realized we were sending each other these sex solicitation warrants from Vernal. And we just thought it was like an interesting way to patrol this kind of crime. And it was happening a lot. We were seeing a lot of these warrants. In the 1 month that we looked at, Detective Smith had filed more warrants than any other officer in the state.
Can I interrupt you there for a second and ask what the warrants were for? I mean, you're getting a warrant to...
Some of them were to get access to the men's cell phones so that they could look at the text messages that were going on. Some of them might have been to keep money, because they would take, like, if he agreed to pay $100 for sex, then they would take that $100 and seize it.
Okay.
So that's kind of where he'd ask for those search warrants to get access to, like, those items that led to the sex solicitation crime. So after we did our project about the e-warrants, about like February, we decided like this is kind of an interesting, weird thing that's going on. So Aubrey had requested all of the police reports from Vernal, and we looked at the court records. All the solicitation cases have been filed in court, and kind of like built this little database kind of got a really good picture of what Detective Smith's techniques were like.
Hmm. And those techniques involved, which is part of the interesting story, is that it involved creating personalities. And this is something that is done, I think, by law enforcement, creating whole personalities for the sort of bait, the women who were not real women. The pictures, though, may have been real women from somewhere in the world. But he was embodying them in the text message. And he would carry on conversations for quite a long time with the people he was trying to have the sting brought down upon, I guess.
Yeah. With those cases where he was posing as an adult, most of them were done within a couple of days to like a week. The child cases were really interesting because he would talk to them for a really long time. There were some where, you know, they had a relationship for like 8 months. They were boyfriend and girlfriend. You know, he at that time, he's posing as like a 12-year-old girl. And, you know, he would get into a relationship with these guys. There was one guy that he talked on and off with for 3 years before they made an arrest in the case. And so it's just really interesting how much time he was spending. And a lot of them overlapped. Like there was one day where you could like you spread out all the police reports and you could see that he was having conversations with like three different guys simultaneously all in one day, posing as different people. So, like one time he's a child and this other time he's this adult woman. And it was just interesting to see all the work that he was putting into these cases.
Yeah, it's almost, so why did Detective Smith make this his sort of pet project? Why was he you had a brief interview with him. Why was this such a focus for him? You said it came from maybe this training, but...
Yeah. He said that that's kind of where it started, where he was looking at Craigslist to look for child cases and saw these adult seeking casual sex from other adults, and he thought that it was important to protect his community from this sort of sexual behavior. I'm not exactly sure, but he thought that this was an important thing to focus on. But since we started asking about these cases in February, he stopped doing them. So that's not something they're doing right now. But they said I asked them like if that had to do with us and us like poking around and kind of asking about it. And they said that it was a coincidence that he's doing other work now and the detectives are focused on a crosswalk initiative
for the moment. But that they promised to come back to this. Part of this also has to do with what's been shut down on the internet. They pointed to Backpage.com being shut down, which was a sex solicitation, almost like an open sex solicitation site.
Yeah. So Congress in March, I think, they passed this this law that basically criminalized having like open ads posing or, you know, offering sex. And so the government actually took down Backpage.com, and Craigslist was kind of like, this is not worth our time to offer these personal ads if we could be like prosecuted by the federal government for child sex trafficking. So Craigslist took down the ads themselves. So I think a lot of law enforcement, not just Vernal, but law enforcement everywhere, kind of grappling with, like, where's the next platform going to be where people are going to be offering to pay for sex online, like whether that's the dark web or whatever the next future platform might be.
But the Vernal Police Department promises to be there, essentially, to try
and...
Yeah,
yeah, that's what they said.
I want to bring George Pyle in on this. George, Jessica also spoke with a Santa Clara University law professor who talked about the sort of problematic nature of law enforcement officers building up rapport and trust with somebody and then presenting them with an opportunity to do something illegal. And that line between entrapment and just pushing someone to do something they may otherwise be willing to do. I don't know.
Well, I mean, it's one thing. I mean, these law enforcement officers, they get this training and they get this mission. And of course, you know, running down people who think they're talking to 12-year-old girls and think they're going to get to have sex with 12-year-old girls. Everybody agrees that's a horrible thing. And if there's anything you can do to catch these guys to make sure that they don't actually do this kind of thing, that's wonderful. When you're talking about consenting adults, whether there's money involved or not, to me, we haven't editorialized on this as a newspaper, but to me, ethically, this is entrapment. This is pushing people from what they thought, you know, was a hookup that maybe didn't involve money, that was just two consenting adults wanting to do what technology has done, from books to photography to movies to videotape to online. I mean, it's all been driven by sex. I mean, that's what you'll—all these—all of us who try and go online and make money, we can't do it because sports stock scores and sex are the only things people will pay for online. And to me, it's entrapment. To me, it's a waste of their time. To me, it's the modern electronic speed trap. I mean, you drive through town, and New York is notorious for this. Little towns in New York, the speed limit is 55. You go over the rise, the speed limit is 25. Well, nobody can slow down that fast, and that's how these cities make their money.
Right.
You know, they catch you, and the fine is $100. You pay it. You drive on. You just think, well, I'm not going to do that again.
Is there money coming to Vernal, the Vernal Police Department, from this? I mean, other than from these seizures, I guess, of the money that people are paying.
Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know how much directly goes to the police department, but you know, these guys are paying fines between like $400 and $680 in the court system, and it's hard to tell. Like the state doesn't keep a breakdown of like this much money came from this type of crime, but just kind of like adding up the cases that I found and that I saw, it looks like in like the last couple years they're getting about like $12,000. I mean, they're getting not like a huge chunk of money, but quite a bit from this type of case solely.
And then just on the entrapment thing, before we move on to a break and then head to other stories, some of the people who were wrapped up in this sting that Detective Smith was doing, is it true that some of them weren't actually paying money, that it may have been other kinds of like hotel room costs, vouchers or something like that?
No, it was actually okay. Detective Smith who was posing as a woman, saying that he had a hotel voucher, which that also was problematic to some of the experts that we talked to, because they said, like, well, this guy could just argue like...
equal parts, essentially.
Right.
You have the hotel.
Like the hotel, it was always the same hotel in Vernal, where rooms were like $100, and these guys are agreeing to pay like $40 or $50 or $80 for sex. So they're paying less than the value of the hotel. So the argument could be made that like I wasn't paying for sex, I was just like paying my part of this hotel room. So that was like another part of the sting that some people thought was pretty problematic.
Yeah, and it would be problematic if and only if somebody was going to challenge that at trial, which didn't happen, of course.
Right, exactly.
Well, really interesting reporting by Jessica Miller and your former colleague, Aubrey Weber. Sorry about that. And you can check it out at sltrib.com. We need to head to our next break in the show. You're listening to Behind the Headlines here on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. We'll be right back.
Saturday on Weekend Edition, the latest on the Kavanaugh hearings, and the story of a man who spent 27 years in prison for crime he didn't commit. Golf Digest became interested in his case because of his sketches of golf courses, and today, Valentino Dixon is a free man. His story, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Tomorrow morning from 6 to 9 a.m. on Utah Public Radio.
Is Utah Public Radio a road trip staple for your family? Do you listen while running errands around town or tune into your favorite program while cleaning? The UPR staff is sharing where we listen to public radio on our social media accounts, and we want you to join us. Share your favorite listening locations with us via email or on social media using the hashtag WhereIListenUPR. We can't wait to hear from you.
Mumford & Sons were once the biggest band in the world. Banjos, acoustic guitars, no drum kit, no one had seen anything like it. Then, like Dylan before them, they went electric. Mumford & Sons will talk about their new album and for the first time address a controversial photo that led to an online backlash. That's coming up on Q from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 1 on Utah Public Radio.
Make an appointment with Public Radio's favorite family doc on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health. It'll be a jam-packed hour on healthy living, including this recipe for
Southwestern Tofu Scramble.
We always have a great time, so will you, on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX.
Sunday morning at 11 on Utah Public Radio.
Utah Public Radio's newest show began in the line at a university coffee shop. Standing before me was a historian. Behind me, there was a physicist, and as we...
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I am joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Taylor Stevens, Jessica Miller, and George Pyle. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us by calling 801-355-8255 or commenting at sltrib.com. Your questions and comments are welcome on the stories we're covering today. Taylor Stevens, there is a man named Sam Young who has been advocating for an end to a practice that the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints had been engaged in. He's led a campaign against the one-on-one interviews with bishops and or between bishops and Mormon adolescents because of the sometimes sexually explicit questions that have been asked in these meetings. Taylor Stevens, this week Sam Young was excommunicated from the faith. Why?
So what the church has to say about the excommunication is that it is not about his concerns with these one-on-one interviews, but instead is because of his aggressive and persistent effort to persuade other people to join his cause. So they're saying that this is more about his tactics than about his beliefs.
Right. And he was reading a letter actually here in Salt Lake City this week in which he that came from the church, his excommunication letter, that described conduct contrary to the laws and order of the church. And I guess what specifically are the kinds of methods that he was or the kinds of actions that he was engaged in that they objected to? Did they comment on that?
So
the church, that is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
So he had actually flown from Texas to read his letter in front of Temple Square, across the street from Temple Square. And so what we had is, you know, I haven't actually seen a copy of this letter. He read it out loud in front of a pretty rowdy group of people on Sunday. And so in this letter, which is from his local lay leaders in Houston, They like I said, called out his tactics, which I think that, you know, among them, reading your excommunication letter publicly is in itself kind of an aggressive tactic. And so that's kind of what they had pointed to. But I don't think anyone has publicly read their excommunication letter, at least, you know, from what I know. So what the local church leaders have said is that this was a local decision on the part of the Texas kind of community, and that they're not able to talk about it because basically, I mean, kind of personnel, you know, and not personnel, that's not the right term, but just basically this is a private decision that they're not really able to comment on further.
What does this mean for him? I mean, you know, being excommunicated, you're no longer a member of the faith, I guess. How does he feel about that? And what, you know, what recourse does he have?
Yeah, so he will still be able to attend church services, and there's the potential that he could become a member again if he were to repent and to you know, kind of demonstrate to church leaders that he had changed his ways, I suppose. But he's not able to take on any roles in leadership in the church. He's not able to enter the temples of the church's faith, anything like that. He can appeal the decision from, I believe, 30 days of when the letter was sent to the first presidency. And how it moves forward from there, I'm not sure, but it does sound like there is some kind of opening for him to appeal to higher leadership and go from there. As to how he feels about the excommunication, before he opened the letter, he talked about how excommunication is often viewed as this kind of taboo topic that people don't really want to talk about, something that happens in private that's shameful. And so I think that by reading it publicly, he wanted to demonstrate that whatever happened, he was going to own it, that he wanted people to be aware of what was happening so that he could continue bolstering this cause. So although he said that, you know, he would wear whatever happened as a badge of honor, he did seem disappointed when he found out. It definitely wasn't the outcome that he wanted. So, you know, I think that he had other hopes, obviously.
Just how about the policy that he has been advocating to see changed? This is the you know, the one-on-one interviews. Hasn't the church kind of modified that practice? And can you talk about that?
Right. In March, they updated their policies, adding the option that an interviewee, one a youth, could have another adult present if they asked for or desired that. And they have also stated that bishops are taught to avoid kind of graphic details during these interviews and not to kind of be probing in their questioning. But Young kind of points to the unequal power dynamic in these relationships when you have a young child in a position with somebody that they trust, and that they may not understand the inappropriateness of a situation, or they may go along with it because this is somebody that they trust, somebody that they look up to. So he's pointed to the unequal power dynamics as a continuing issue, and he would like to see another adult always be present and have that a requirement.
And he's somebody who has some experience with this, having been a Mormon bishop himself, correct?
And I believe that his daughters had this experience, and that's what pushed him onto this cause. And I believe one of his daughters left the church in part because of the experience of these kind of probing interviews as a young person in the church.
There have been some other high-profile excommunications in the past few years. I mean, this isn't happening in a sort of vacuum. Other people have been pushed out of the church for being essentially activists. Can you talk about that as well, Taylor?
Right. So Kate Kelly, who was pushing for female ordination to the church's all-male priesthood, she was ousted from the church in 2014. And then John DeLynn, who is a podcaster who was broadcasting his doubts about church teachings, he was excommunicated in 2015. So Young's excommunication comes on the heels of those.
George, I want to bring you in on this. But first, Taylor, actually, I have one more question, which is what does Young say about the changes that the church has instituted around these one-on-one interviews? I didn't hear his response. Obviously, he kept advocating for further change. I guess you did address this a little bit.
Yeah, he, like I said, he just doesn't think that it goes far enough. And he wants to see, you know, I think the church would say we've made changes, we've addressed this. And he would say, obviously, he's going to keep advocating for this until they draw a harder line, I guess.
George Pyle, is this the same category of excommunication as you know, the John DeLynn excommunication or Kate Kelly? Kelly excommunication. Yeah. I don't know. What do you make of the changes also of the interviews that the church or in this interview process that the church says that it has enacted?
Well, I can see why they thought the changes were necessary. I can see why he thinks that they're not enough because it is an unbalanced situation. I mean, if the bishop just kind of gives you a glance that indicates that no, you can't bring your mother in with you, or no, you can't bring your uncle in with you, or somebody to make you feel like you've sort of balanced the scales, then they feel like they're supposed to do what they're told by the person sitting in front of them. And it doesn't matter what the official doctrine is. And, you know, if the official doctrine were firm, it says the child will always have a trusted adult in the room with them. If then that's left up to the local discretion. And the church is pretty big on local discretion. I mean, even with all the structure it has and all the, you know, the, its presidency and everything, it has lay leadership. It has all these people. It's not their paying job. It's a calling that they do on the side. And so they're left a lot of discretion in how they handle a lot of things. But I think the church, with the ordained women and everything else, is putting itself in a position where it makes it very clear that it won't brook any dissent. And, it, you know, you toe the line or you're out. And I was just, I mean, we haven't taken an official editorial position on this, but in my column this week, I talk about this is like this joke that Nikita Khrushchev used to tell on himself when he was a leader of the Soviet Union. He said there was this guy running through the Kremlin saying, "Khrushchev is a fool, Khrushchev is a fool." And they arrested him and they sent him to prison for 23 years, 3 years for insulting the government and 20 years for revealing a state secret. And so what the church seems to be worried about is revealing state secrets.
And so, and this excommunication is, in your mind, about making an example so that
making an example so nobody else will talk out of turn. And I don't see how you run an organization like that, but they seems to be their preference.
Well, there's a lot more to this story, but I wanted to be almost out of time, and I want to return to one final story before we get there. So check out Taylor Stevens' reporting on this. She actually spoke with people who had some difficult experiences in Bishop's interviews that they revealed to her. Check it out at sltrip.com. But before we turn to our underplayed stories, just quickly, Jessica Miller, an update on a story from, you know, almost decades ago now. This is the release of Wanda Barzee, who was one of Elizabeth Smart's captors. She's been freed from prison after serving a certain amount of time. We were expecting her to actually serve more time because she missed a parole hearing, and there was, I even in a morning newscast, I reported that she was going to be in prison until 2024. Why is she out now?
So this was kind of a confusing outcome, but the parole board actually miscalculated, or they didn't really miscalculate. They didn't. They thought that they could disregard the time that she had spent in federal prison and keep her in the state prison longer, because she had pled guilty to charges in both federal court and state court. There was this plea deal that was worked out then. On paper, it seems like everybody knew about it. It was supposed to be these concurrent sentences, so they're supposed to run, you know, at the same time as each other. And I do believe that they also had agreed that there was some time when she had spent, you know, in the county jail before she was convicted, and she was in the Utah State Hospital when there was questions about her competency, and she also got credit for that time served. So altogether, I mean, she's been in some kind of jail or prison or mental health, you know, in the state hospital since she was arrested in 2003. So it's been about 15 and a half years that she's been behind bars.
And this is, you know, I didn't even introduce this story and bring up the fact that or tell the story of the Elizabeth Smart kidnapping, because it's almost, I feel like it's common knowledge out there.
Yeah.
But back in 2002, Elizabeth Smart, as a 15-year-old, was 14-year-old, was kidnapped from her home here in Salt Lake City and held for quite a while. She, Elizabeth Smart, who experienced this terrible ordeal at the hands of Barzee and this guy, Brian David Mitchell, she's understandably upset about the release of Barzee, correct?
Right. Like I said, back when they did this plea deal, it seemed like everybody knew that this was what was happening. But then when more recently, when Wanda had her first parole hearing, she didn't come. And the parole board member made a comment like she hadn't done any of her mental health treatment or evaluations. And then the board came with this decision, like, we're going to disregard your federal sentence. Now you're not going to get out until at least like 2024. So they did that. And then some legal counsel, some attorney looked at this and said, like, whoa, this isn't legal. You actually can't disregard that federal sentence. So just about like a week or two ago, I think Elizabeth or the Smart family found out maybe like 2 weeks ago. And the parole board announced it publicly just last week, saying, well, we messed up. She's going to be let out in like a couple of weeks. And so she was let out on Wednesday.
Okay. She has 5 years of probation, you know, federal supervision. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more to the story. And in fact, her lawyer is arguing that she's being sort of defamed.
Yeah. Well, the Smart family obviously has concerns that she's still a public safety risk, especially if she hasn't done any of the mental health treatment. And state court, she pleaded guilty but mentally ill. So she kind of got that benefit when she made that plea deal, and she hasn't done any of this treatment. So they're obviously concerned that she might be a safety risk. Wanda's attorney says, hey, you know, she hasn't done anything to show yet that she is a safety risk. She just kind of wants to, like, do her own thing. She wants to be on federal supervision, which part of that does require that she goes through mental health treatment. So maybe now she'll get it done. But but it kind of sounds like she just wants to be left alone.
All right. With that, Jessica Miller, we need to turn to our final segment of the show. Thank you for your reporting, available at sltrip.com. Final segment of the show is the underplayed stories of the week, where we highlight some stories that maybe could use more coverage or that stood out for us. And George Pyle, are you ready with an underplayed story?
Well, this is going to have a lot of play as things go along. It just broke recently. The federal government, federal agencies that are supervising this Lake Powell pipeline, in the opinion of the editorial board boondoggle, have said that, no, you don't just have to get a permit from one agency. You're going to have to get a permit from three or four or five agencies, and which could be the end of this project. It certainly is going to have it take longer and cost more money. Our advice would be that they realize that there's not going to be any water in Lake Powell anyway to pipe, and they ought to just give up on it.
Okay. George Pyle's pick, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, saying that it has limited jurisdiction when it comes to the proposed Lake Powell pipeline. Taylor Stevens, are you ready with an underplayed story?
Yeah, I want to talk about a billboard that appeared on a 6 South off-ramp on I-15 on Thursday. And I just want to read what the billboard said. It asked people to vote yes on Prop 2, which is the ballot initiative for legalizing medical marijuana. And the billboard says, quote, "All wholesome herbs God hath ordained for the use of man." And that is from the Word of Wisdom. It's still a mystery who exactly paid for this billboard using church doctrine from the LDS church to support Prop 2, which the church has come out against. So stay tuned.
Stay tuned. Maybe we will find out. Maybe we won't. I don't know who did that advertise that billboard. Jessica Miller, your pick for underplayed story.
I am picking a trial. Rick Korber, who was kind of this prominent Utah real estate investment guru, was convicted yesterday of some fraud charges. The prosecutors first filed these charges like 9 years ago. This is the third time they had a trial last year, and it was ended in a hung jury. So this is a retrial of the case. And then there was another thing back a couple years ago where a judge dismissed the case initially and the government appealed. So after three tries, the federal prosecutors got a conviction of 15 counts of fraud, wire fraud, and money laundering. So he will be sentenced now in January.
Wow. At the end of a very long saga.
So long.
And at the end of a very long reporting saga, I think, for you as well, Jessica Miller. Interesting pick for your underplayed story of the week. I guess I will go with another Prop 2 related story. This is that some Southern Utah sheriff's offices were sharing a Facebook video on their official accounts, and it's their anti-marijuana videos at a time when we're considering an initiative related to medical marijuana in the state. And if they are advocating against it or appear to be using funds to advocate against Prop 2, that may have broken the law. I'm not explaining it well at all, but you can check it out at sltrip.com. This is more reporting from Taylor Stevens, I believe.
Mm-hmm. That's the gist of it.
Fantastic. Thank you. Yeah, you could have told that story better than I did. All right. Well, George Pyle, Taylor Stevens, and Jessica Miller, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Roger.
Thanks also to Jesse Ellis here at KCBW, to the staff at Utah Public Radio in Logan, and to our producer, Emily Means. Thanks, as always, to you for tuning in. I'm Roger McDonough. You've been listening to Behind the Headlines. We'll see you again next week.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Cash Chamber of Commerce 4th Annual Cash Business Women's Conference, presenting keynote speaker Utah's First Lady, Jeanette Herbert, Thursday, October 11th, 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. at the Riverwoods Conference Center. Registration details at cashchamber.com.
Utah Public Radio is a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, KUSUFM Logan. Also heard at upr.org.